Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And I don't know, Peter calls this program the spice of life. I don't know.
Well, it's about a little bit. It's a little bit spicy.
But
it's a little bit spicy. It's
well,
a little
the
bit.
It's
a little bit foreign. It's a little bit domestic. It's kind of spicy all the way through.
Okay.
Except for How to Boil an Egg. That snuck in here because it's a fascinating book written by someone in France who needs to explain to us how to boil eggs. That's pretty spicy.
Yeah.
Okay, but first up, the cuisine that everyone in the know is forecasting as the next great cuisine. It's not Thai, it's not Chinese, it's not Peruvian, it's
Filipino.
How about that? So here's someone who thinks he knows why.
If we were to believe those who do predictions, and a lot of people do, the next big thing, cuisine, coming down the pike, here I guess in the U.S., and maybe anyways, is Philippine cuisine. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, and I think our next guest, Marvin Gapulto, certainly knows a lot about Philippine cuisine, and you probably have an idea about this prediction as well, Marvin. What do you think about this as the next hot cuisine?
I definitely think it's totally possible. Filipino cuisine, as you mentioned, people are predicting it as the next big thing. People like Andrew Zimmern are talking about it, and there's been contestants on Top Chef who've been cooking Filipino food. So it's definitely getting out there in people's minds, and more people are getting interested in it, and hopefully my cookbook will be a tipping point to helping that happen.
You know, the cookbook is called The Adobo Road Cookbook, A Filipino Journey from Food Blog to Food Truck and Beyond, and I'm sure you'll explain that.
Yeah, the title basically is just a summation of how I got started. I actually started as a food blogger. My food blog is Burnt Lumpia, burntlumpiablog.com. I started writing about Filipino food just because I grew up eating Filipino food, but I knew nothing about how to cook it. And I decided to start a food blog and start trial by fire Filipino cooking. And I wrote down some recipes, I blogged about it, and then I got a little bit of a following. And then after that, I opened a Filipino food truck called the Manila Machine, and it was actually Los Angeles's very first Filipino food truck, and it was very successful, very popular, and it was very gratifying being able to serve so many different kinds of people. And it's Los Angeles, so it's just a hodgepodge of cultures, and I was able to serve Filipino food, and people were appreciating it. So that's kind of my background.
Now, Marvin, you're of Philippine heritage, but you were born in the United States?
Yes, I was born in Los Angeles.
But your family came here from the Philippines?
Yes.
How long ago?
Actually, my dad's parents came to California in the 60s. I'm not sure which specific year. And obviously, they brought my father along with them.
Yeah.
So my parents met in the Philippines. My dad had gone back to visit, and then he met my mother, and then they got married. And then she came here in 75.
And so there's quite a community of Filipinos.
Oh, definitely, yes.
Mostly on the West Coast?
I would say mostly, yes, but there's lots of Filipino enclaves on the East Coast as well. And even in the Midwest, I know that there's Filipino populations everywhere, actually. Filipinos are actually, I believe, the second largest Asian population behind Chinese U.S., so there's a good amount of us.
It's almost like a forgotten country, isn't it? It sort of escapes people's attention that it's out there with 7,000 islands, you say in your book?
Yes, there's over 7,000 islands in the Philippines. That actually contributes a lot to the diversity of Filipino cuisine. Different regions of the Philippines have different ways of cooking Filipino dishes, so that's one of the great things with Filipino food. It's just so diverse and so rich in different traditions.
If I were to look at it a little bit differently and then ask you to explain further, it's sort of, the cuisine is sort of based on a set of ingredients which are available locally, and perhaps like banana ketchup, which you can explain a little bit later, because I'm sure our listeners will definitely need to know about that. But then you also write about a number of cultural influences that came from somewhere else, like Spain and Mexico.
Exactly, because the Philippines was a Spanish colony for something like 300 years. That long under colonial rule, there's going to be some influences culturally and culinarily all across the board. So there's definitely Spanish influences in Filipino cuisine. Some parts of the Philippines cook with a sofrito type of combination of tomatoes and onions and oil. That's a base for a lot of Spanish-based Filipino dishes. And so there's influences from Mexico, strangely enough, because Mexico was a colony of Spain at the same time that the Philippines was. So there's something called the Manila-Acapulco galleon trade, which is, it was this Spanish ship that went back and forth between the Philippines and Mexico once or twice a year. And just from that trade, there was Mexican influences were introduced into Filipino cuisine as well. I mean, we've got empanadas and chocolate, I think, came from Mexico. And we the mangoes from the Philippines were exported to Mexico. And that's how Mexico...
Well, I think part of the reason why Philippine cuisine isn't so well-known and appreciated in the U.S. is because of this diversity. I don't know how you define what it is, because there's so much of it. You had the Portuguese in there, you had all kinds of things going on. And I opened this book, and the first thing I saw was glazed Spam, which I thought, oh dear, dear, dear. And now I just opened it to grilled chicken rotters.
Right.
Which is a photograph.
So that's, that just shows, the sheer diversity.
Then you turn around and have a stuffed and grilled whole trout, which looks just like something we would have in any European country.
Right, and it's a simple preparation, just wrapped in banana leaf is probably the only difference.
Well, there certain things, however, that you view as really essential in defining Philippine cuisine?
I think, generally speaking, the overarching flavor of Filipino cuisine, there's a sour profile in a lot of our dishes, mainly because we have a lot of vinegar. Our adobo, which is probably the most well-known Filipino dish. Adobo is just a method of cooking any meat or vegetable in a mixture of vinegar, salt, pepper, and garlic. And also just based on pre-refrigeration time. That's kind of like how vinegar obviously is a preservative, so it helped in our cooking as well in a tropical climate to cook things in vinegar. And then also there's a lot of native citrus fruits, like types of limes that we like as well.
Calamansi is one of the...
Yeah.
Can you get that in California?
Yes, you can. And you can actually order it online from different places. That you could order a tree and have your own calamansi, like in a little pot, like a little miniature tree, and it actually bears fruit. So people can actually order calamansi trees.
Like my lemongrass plant.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, well, listen, I didn't know that story, but we're not going to repeat it about my endless transition between seasons of my lemongrass plant. But there are other things, and you have a section called Stocking Your Filipino Pantry.
Yes.
And you have things in here. I would put bitter melon in with Chinese cooking. That's in there. Anano seeds I put in with Mexican cooking, and that's in there. The banana leaves, which go to a lot of tropical places. Then you have, Edam cheese? What's that about?
That's another import from Spain. I know Edam, I think, is Dutch, but
yeah, they are.
For some reason, Spanish brought over that cheese, and it just stuck with Filipinos. So it's actually a cheese that's given out during the holidays, around Christmas time normally. And it's a salty. And so one of the ways Edam cheese is used is on, it might be grated onto a dirt, just as a salty counterpoint, which is interesting, because kind of the big thing nowadays is to sprinkle sea salt on...
Right.
On desserts. So it's kind of the same principle. The Edam cheese adds that saltiness to desserts.
You know, come to think of it, I have that recipe from Curacao that calls for Edam cheese.
Well, but Curacao was a Dutch possession, so it was a direct, direct link there. I think the missing link, if you like to think of it that way, and you have to know European history to understand this, is that during the 16th and the early 17th century, Spain actually controlled what we now call the Low Countries, Belgium and the Netherlands.
Oh, wow, yeah.
So Edam cheese from Holland, if you like, found its way into the trade as a result of the fact that the Spaniards would have brought it from the Netherlands to Mexico, I guess, and then it got on the galleons and headed for the Philippines.
Exactly. It's strange how that works, but that's how it is.
Now, did we talk about Chinese influence? I mean, China's sort of like your big neighbor.
Yeah, and obviously they're a big trading partner, and so the most obvious Chinese influences are actually our noodles, pancit noodles, which are, there's a whole variety of pancit noodles and dumplings, and similar to Chinese chow mein or wontons and things like that. And also our spring rolls, with
sure. Why not? Yeah.
A direct influence from China.
Marvin, you're going to have to explain burnt lumpia.
Like I mentioned, I started the blog not really knowing how to cook Filipino food. So I just, it was kind of a tongue-in-cheek name for the blog because whenever I cooked lumpia starting out, I always seemed to burn at least one. So it was kind of just a tongue-in-cheek name, and I know for the most part people are familiar with lumpia. So I thought it was a funny name that kind of described, I guess, my writing style, and that it was like an indicator that this was a Filipino food blog. So that's where the name burnt lumpia came from.
And then, of course, on top of everything else, you add your own interpretation, which makes it even more interesting and more difficult to sort through the different threads, I guess, because you do translate things in your own, through your own sensibilities, right?
Yes.
And what are some of the touches that you've added?
Well, certain things, I there's still definitely Filipino food. I just think I present it in a different way. There's something that comes to mind is corn and coconut milk pudding, which is usually made, in the traditional sense, it's usually thickened with cornstarch, but I use gelatin to give it a richer texture. So that's just simple, you know, simple things like that, just simple changes to really any cuisine, to bring a dish to a different level, to a different, just presenting it differently to people, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I think it does. I'm really beginning to think that basically people are going to want the recipes in your cookbook, not because it's a separate new cuisine, but because the recipes are interesting and tasty.
Well, thank you. I hope so.
Anyhow, do they drink a lot in the Philippines? Because you have a lot of cocktails.
Yeah, that's another interesting part of Filipino cuisine. We have our own native liquors from rice or different native fruits, but we also have something called pulutong, which is finger food that is usually eaten with beer or liquor. So it's kind of like, if you think of Spanish tapas, it's kind of the same kind of idea. So there's a whole subset of Filipino food that is just bar food, and I have a little section of that in my book. And also, it's the tiki cocktail culture here in the U.S. was actually started in Los Angeles in the 1930s or 40s, and a lot of the staff of these tiki bars were Filipino-Americans. So that's another interesting kind of historical note, that Filipinos had a big hand in the tiki cocktail culture here in America.
Huh, interesting. I never knew that at all.
Well, was it Trader Vic's? Was that a restaurant?
Yes.
It was a restaurant that was big on tiki?
Oh, yeah.
That's one of the big ones, yes.
Okay, now, here's something. My greengrocer has bitter melons all the time, and I never know what to do with them. Uh-huh. Here's a recipe for, is this a good thing to do? You scoop the center out, and you make it into a quiche?
Yes. Yeah, you want to use a spoon or a grapefruit spoon to take out the center pith and the seed. A lot of bitterness is in the center part, but I mean, bitter melon is bitter melon. It's going to be bitter no matter what. So that's a good way to prep it.
And you do nose-to-tail stuff, so that's going to be another attraction to the cuisine. And you do
right.
Pig's ears and chicken feet and things like that as well.
So lots of good bits and nibbles for everybody.
Well, I mean, I'm really interested in seeing how this goes, Marvin. See, what kind of reception have you gotten so far?
So far it's been good. It's still early. The book will be is released in May, but so far the reception has been good. People seem excited about my book, and based off of my experience with my food truck, I know there's people who want Filipino food and who want to try it and understand it more, and hopefully my book will help spark that interest in Filipino food.
Well, Marvin, when you do the sequel, because Filipino food is mainstream, you must come back and talk to us again and explain how you helped make that happen, too. In the meantime, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been such fun talking to you, and I think that the population in Los Angeles is hoping that you go back into the food truck business, too.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you having me on. Thank you so much.
Marvin, good luck to you. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much.
And you thought adobo was something they built houses from in Mexico, didn't you? And now you know differently.
That's adobe.
I know. Well, when you described the program in one of your emails, you had Adobe in there as well. But we now know that Adobo is something entirely different. We're very smart, and you're all prepared to catch the next Filipino wave for yourself. And we'll be back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. If you're looking for somebody who is, well, let's put it as it is, fanatical about barbecue, we've got somebody for you, Rob Walsh, who wrote Barbecue Crossroads, but I mean, he knows every little nook and cranny of the barbecue universe, I guess you'd call it.
Even when it was invented.
Yes. And he's a whole lot of information and a pleasant guy to talk to.
And to say he's passionate about it would be to understate things, I think.
I said fanatical.
let's hear what we talked about.
Yes, Rob Walsh is a multifaceted person, food writer, Beard Award winner. How many times, Rob? Lots of times. Three, I think.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes. I thought you were a former restaurant critic, but you said you just moved back into a job with Houstonian Magazine as their restaurant critic. So you do that.
That's right, yeah.
And
back in the saddle.
Back in the saddle. And I actually have chased you through several books trying to set up an interview with you, so you're much in demand. But finally did over this particular book, which is a winner, called Barbecue Crossroads, Notes and Recipes from a Southern Odyssey. And I should start out by saying that, first of all, people are going to be drawn in with these photographs by a famous photographer, O. Rufus Lovett, whose father was a brilliant photographer, you told me.
That's true, yeah. He was a photographer shortly after the Depression, shooting in Alabama, so Rufus has big shoes to fill.
Now, I think that if you pick up this book and look at these photographs, you know that the story is a lot more than just barbecue.
It's really, I call it kind of a barbecue spirit quest. We didn't really rate or rank barbecue restaurants. There's nothing in the book about this one's better than that one. This is a book about the American barbecue culture and basically a search for the roots of this tradition, which I call the greatest American artisan food tradition.
And what did you discover? You went looking.
There's a whole book about
that. I understand, but we got to start somewhere.
Well, I started out by being greatly disappointed. Some of the famous places that I went looking for were either not there anymore or had fallen, they're sitting on their laurels, or however you want to describe, a place which has gone to ruin.
And but you list them and you tell people so that people are not just dragged into these places like they are with ink.
Well, but the story of hope in the end was I discovered something that had been my nose and under all of our noses all this time, and that was the community barbecue. I found barbecues in Texas, an area that was the oldest part of Texas that was settled in the 1820s, and I found German dance halls where they had barbecue pits. There were pits in the ground like you see in the photos from the 1800s, and they were still carrying on this tradition that they'd been carrying on for 150 years. And so as I found that restaurants across the country were switching to these stainless steel virtual barbecue ovens that were turning barbecue into the fast food. At the same time, we still have these community barbecue traditions, which are closer to the old way of doing barbecue than anything I've ever seen.
Now, there's another barbecue area as well that we've come across that is, I don't know whether it's become a rage or it always was a rage, and that's all these barbecue contests where people with their mobile units compete. They drive across the country and they compete for prizes and they make their product available to give you two ends of the scale, and then I'll allow you to fill in between. We were in Greenwood, South Carolina, which is where our son and daughter-in-law and their children live, on a particular day which was, I think, one of 3 days of the Greenwood Barbecue Contest. And that's at one end of the scale, because this is a town of maybe 10,000, 20,000
people. People from New York there.
I was going on to say that the same people, or many of the same people, were at the barbecue contest that Danny Meyer and some other people organized in New York City. And it's the same guys.
Well, actually, there's a big difference between those two events. And the difference is that Danny Meyer's Big Apple Barbecue Block Party isn't a contest. There's no competition. He brings the most famous pit masters around the country to New York to show New Yorkers what great traditional barbecue is. A barbecue cook-off, on the other hand, there's a whole chapter in the book about barbecue cook-offs, and I started judging barbecue cook-offs years ago when they were wonderful little affairs under the shade tree where barbecue lovers came together. But in this day and age, the television show Barbecue Pitmasters in particular has turned the whole thing into a... It reminds me of the World Wrestling Federation. We've got people who are injecting the meat with phosphates and rubbing it with MSG and doing absolutely anything to win. And this barbecue that they're producing might win a prize, but it's just not something you want to feed to your family.
Well, see, I knew you'd answer the question. I wasn't sure I knew what the answer was going to be, but we did get that. Now, they do seem to take it very seriously.
Well, for many, many years, barbecue cook-offs have just been wonderful affairs that I've had. I've been to many of them, judged, participated, and had a great time. But in the latter days of the barbecue cook-off, some people, particularly some television personalities, have gotten into it, and they've turned it into a all or nothing, I'm going to win, I'm going to slice you guys to ribbons kind of a proposition. And it makes for great television, but it's just not the spirit of the American barbecue, which was a community event in the beginning. In the 1820s, there were barbecues at church revivals and political rallies, and just about every big party in America had a big outdoor barbecue, and it was there because it brought people together.
And you also mentioned,
I think the modern spirit of the barbecue cook-off, it started to drive people apart.
You mentioned also that there's a huge connection to the African-American community, and part of you said that this was a place where they could go to eat when they weren't even allowed in restaurants.
Well, the African-American holiday in Texas celebrating emancipation is called Juneteenth, and Juneteenth was celebrated back at the very first time, I believe, 1865, with big public barbecues. And to this day, these big public barbecues are part of the Juneteenth, which is June 19th celebration here in Texas. And this celebration has been picked up by other African-American communities across the country. And barbecue is really the central symbol of the Juneteenth party. So the fact is, it was African-Americans who were doing the cooking in the plantation barbecue style of the Old South. There were probably some white foremen standing around, but the guys who did the cooking were African-American.
Right.
So it's very much an African-American tradition. And the other problem I have with barbecue cook-offs is there are very, very few African-American contestants in barbecue contests.
This is
right,
true.
Right, yeah, I noticed that. So that's very interesting.
They've been driven away in large part by a lot of people who feel necessary to fly Confederate flags and basically make them feel unwelcome.
I got it now. So the tradition of barbecuing really goes back to the plantation era in the South.
Well, etymologically, the origins of the word go back to the Caribbean, to Native Americans, but that's a long story.
Yeah, okay.
The first barbecue I ever put in my mouth, I think it's interesting to note, was Isley's Chipped Ham with Heinz barbecue sauce.
And that was in Pittsburgh.
I grew up until I was 7 in Pittsburgh, and when my mom said we were having barbecue, that's what she meant. And I think a lot of people in Pittsburgh still think of barbecue as Isley's Chipped Ham with barbecue sauce.
I think I was had an advanced, a sophisticated palate, because I never ate that stuff. It was disgusting.
that's a nice way of putting it, dude.
You really, in a way, this book's... I started out with it, getting to feel the nostalgia. It's rife with nostalgia. That it was kind of depressing me. And then, of course, you found these bright spots, and the characters, I think, are the highlight of this book, too. The people involved that you met in this journey. And we haven't defined the journey. How did this start out? You had criteria?
Well, it started out with Rufus and I doing a article for Saveur magazine called Zen and the Art of Barbecue. And basically the idea was when I quit being a restaurant critic for the newspaper, I found myself going to barbecue joints and just hanging around and talking to people. When I was an anonymous critic, I couldn't do that. So I just had more fun in barbecue joints than I'd ever had before. And so I pitched this story to Saveur, and I took Rufus around with me, and we sort of documented just the sort of culture of barbecue, and the places that we were taking pictures of weren't even recognized as the best barbecue places. They were just, there was a place that had started out as a gas station and convenience store in the 20s, and took a picture of some barbecue in the middle of a 50-year-old table that used to have a formica top. It was worn out in the diamond, kind of rounded diamond shape, and it turned out it was from people playing dominoes at the table for 50 years.
Isn't that amazing?
So it's just, I mean, it's just a beautiful relic to look at. It took a lot of pictures of old knives and barbecue forks and the pits and just the sort of, I mean, the sort of artifacts that define barbecue as an American artisan food tradition.
Now, how is it that there are several different sourcing traditions? Because there's North Carolina, and there's Memphis, and then there's Texas. They all start in the same place and diverge. What happened there?
Well, the sauce that came from the Caribbean to the old plantations on the east coast of North Carolina and Virginia were vinegar with peppers. Basically, it was just some hot chili peppers shoved in a bottle of vinegar and with a little maybe black pepper and salt, and that was the basic barbecue sauce. Actually, the red sauce of western North Carolina, of the Piedmont district, had a German origin. Both in Texas and in North Carolina, you see that the old barbecue culture came from the plantation from the Old South, and the new barbecue culture came from German immigrants. The Germans came to Pennsylvania in the 1700s and couldn't find any farmland, so they took the Great Wagon Trail south, and some settled in Virginia, but lots ended up in the Piedmont area of North Carolina, and they began cooking the German shoulder, which is called a Schaffel in Germany, and is traditional in Franconia and Baden, and to this shoulder, they began to add a sauce which contained ketchup, which, of course, was popularized by Mr. Hines there in Pittsburgh. So the old-style plantation barbecue stuck with their vinegar sauce, and the German immigrants switched to the ketchup-based sauce. And the two groups, they talk about the conflict between vinegar barbecue sauce and ketchup-based barbecue sauce, but that conflict isn't about barbecue sauce. Those two cultures have been at odds for hundreds of years. In the 1760s, the German farmers, the yeoman farmers of the Piedmont, rose up in a war called the Regulator War, where they challenged the British, colonial British government when British soldiers marched over there and shot some of them. So, now when they say there's a conflict between vinegar barbecue sauce and ketchup barbecue sauce, there's a little more behind it than that.
It sure sounds like it. Now,
Price, you shook a nerve when you mentioned this origins in Germany and Austria, and then I realized that the Mangalitsa comes from Austria anyhow, doesn't it?
It does, yes.
Funny, I never think of it going to Germany or Austria. I never think of looking
for barbecue. Well, and we had the same thing here in Texas. The oldest style of barbecue is African-American in East Texas, and lots of barbecue sauce, lots of pork, whereas in the meat market barbecue style of Central Texas, it was German and Czech butchers who began cooking. Well, they were really just smoking leftover meats, and they didn't have any barbecue sauce because it wasn't intended to be barbecue. It was just German sausage, smoked sausage, and German smoked pork. But what happened was African-American and Mexican cotton pickers back in the early part of the 20th century, when they weren't allowed in restaurants, and they were picking cotton in all these little towns in Texas. So they'd go to the meat market, and there was all this hot prepared meat, and so they bought it, and they just ate it on the butcher paper it came on with the stuff that they could get from the store shelves, like crackers and block of cheddar, pickles, and there were no utensils, and there was no barbecue sauce. And that was the German meat market tradition for many, many years. And it continued that way because if they had tables and plates and it could be construed as a restaurant, then they would have been subject to the Jim Crow segregation laws.
Now, you don't acknowledge as a barbecue place any place that does not use hardwood. That was one of your criteria in finding these barbecue joints?
Well, let's put it this way. It's not my job to decide who serves legitimate barbecue and who doesn't. The word barbecue is part of the language, and people in New York call hamburgers and hot dogs barbecue, and so be it. Everyone will use the word as they will, and the dictionary will define our common usage. But the places that I'm, let's put it this way, the places that I'm interested in, the places that are still making an artisan product are the places using old-fashioned pits. Because the difference between barbecue that's stuck into a stainless steel push-button oven and barbecue that's cooked over a fire with a pit master prodding it and poking it and checking it all night is the difference between Wonder Bread and artisan bread.
There you go. Now, when we were in Kansas City, the place everybody went was Arthur Bryant's.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the first time I went there, someone who was local took me there, and he said that the story is that the barbecue pit's never been cleaned. Now, is that part of the magic and the flavor?
Well, I'll tell you, part of the magic of real pit barbecue is the pits catch fire all the time. It's amazing. Every old pit I went and visited in the South, I'd look at the ceiling and you'd see black marks where the pig had caught fire and set the place on fire. Sometimes they manage to put it out, and sometimes they don't. When I visited Aiden, North Carolina, Skylight Inn, they had two pit houses, and I said, well, do you use them both? And they said, no, we just use this one. And I said, well, why do you have two? And they said, well, that's our insurance policy. said, one burnt down one time, and so when we built this one, we tried to get in fire insurance, and they said we had to put in this incredibly expensive fire suppression system with all these sprinklers and everything. Said it was cheaper to just build another barbecue and build another smokehouse. So we just built two, and if this one burns down, we'll just switch to the other one.
Now, is there advice in this book for the home barbecuer? I mean,
oh, absolutely.
I was about to say there are recipes in here.
The book is at its core a cookbook. I'm an avid barbecuer, and I was as interested in learning how to cook whole hog and pork shoulder and all of these specialties of the Old South as I was in documenting the culture. And in fact, that is, in my opinion, part of documenting the culture is documenting the techniques.
Yes, and you have not only just barbecue recipes, but all the accoutrement, all the sides, and all the, including fried pies, which I've never understood.
Yeah, there are some connections in barbecue that are real head-scratchers. The other thing is every African-American barbecue place I know has catfish.
Yeah, you mentioned this one place you went to, that's all they had, fried catfish.
Well, as it turned out, I showed up on a Tuesday, which was their first day open after the weekend, and they had been written up in a newspaper, and they were totally cleaned out of barbecue when I got there on Tuesday morning. They were cooking lots of it, and I got to go watch him working on the barbecue that would be ready later on, but at that moment, the only thing he had to serve me was fried catfish, and he was another of the pit masters who was also a full-time preacher.
Yeah, I was surprised at that. A lot of them are preachers, too. There's a connection here between the Bible and the...
Yeah, and you were talking about C.B. Stubblefield and his wonderful barbecue sauce.
Yes.
I'll tell you, I was really surprised and delighted to learn that C.B. Stubblefield's father, Christopher Columbus Stubblefield, was a preacher in Navasota, Texas, where Stubb, as we call him, was born. And that Stubbs learned how to barbecue from his preacher father, who would make a huge barbecue pit and cook a lot of barbecue in order to draw people to come to his revival meetings.
I think we knew that. In fact, when we put this interview up, I'll make sure I put in a link to the interview with the people who now own Stubblefields, because that in itself is a wonderful human story, just as your book is filled with other human stories. And for those people who are interested in more than just scarfing down some barbecue and not worrying about where it comes from, I think that this is an important contribution to the folklore of America as a whole.
Well, thank you. And for those who are busy scarfing down barbecue, want to read something while they're doing it, it works for that too.
Yeah, I think so. Except you get messed up a really pretty book.
Yeah, you should have done like Charlie Palmer. He did a cookbook washable. And it's unwashable plasticized sheets. So there's so if it gets a mess, you can always clean it up.
Next time.
Yeah, Rob, but you just said you were eating salads because you just went to a whole all barbecue thing. So you're still scarfing down the barbecue. You don't ever get tired of it, huh?
My wife has suggested that maybe it's an addiction. I don't know. No, I never get tired of barbecue. Well, no, I take that back. After three solid days of eating barbecue at the barbecue symposium this weekend, I did have a couple of large salads, and they did taste very good. But I'll be back to barbecue pretty soon.
Now, you cook it yourself, right?
Oh, yeah.
So do you have one tip that you think is unusual that will help our listeners to be better barbecuers themselves?
Okay, well, it's kind of an arcane tip, but here it is. A lot of people are trying to cook whole hogs these days, and I know I did. And what I discovered was I went to a meat market. Actually, we've got one here that's selling a cross between the Mangalista pig and another pig. It's a heritage pig. The whole hog would cost you $400 or something like that, and it's really difficult to fit onto a barbecue pit. But they sold me a hog forequarter, which is the shoulder plus about four ribs, and that piece fit just perfectly. It's about 30 pounds. It fit perfectly on my Texas-style offset smoker. And so on my regular old barbecue smoker, I can cook something. After you cook it for 12 hours and you gently bring it along, what you have is a combination of shoulder meat and pork belly that is a really close approximation of the different textures and flavors of pork and whole hog. So before you try a whole hog, try a four quarter. That's my tip.
Sure.
We've done pigs, but a hog I wouldn't get near.
No. So I think that's great advice. The other thing is if you do it that way, you only have 30 pounds of meat instead of hundreds of pounds of meat.
And well, you have 30 pounds of a total. Actually, it shrinks a little bit. By the time you pull the meat off of it, you're really down to only maybe 20, even less.
But you've still got enough to feed the neighborhood.
Yeah, I figure even if they ate half a pound apiece, 16 pounds would feed 32 people. More likely, it's a third of a pound apiece, so you feed 50 people or so.
Well, again, thank you so much for your contribution to
this,
American
this
folklore, and I'm sure there'll be a sequel in there somewhere.
Well, thank you.
When you write it, come back and talk to us again.
Anyhow, Rob, I'm glad we finally touched base with each other, and I hope the contact continues.
All right. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Rob.
Bye.
So who knew that barbecue was a history lesson?
Oh, he knows
so much. And a culture and a whole lot else besides. And we just thought we were eating something spicy that we enjoyed. So now the next time you have barbecue, you'll understand more of the story, and I'm sure you'll appreciate it even more. And we'll be back with more after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back.
Yes, and Rose Carrarini is a delight, absolutely a delight, somebody I would enjoy having breakfast with, and there aren't many people I would like to even think about at breakfast.
And guess what you'd be having for breakfast if you were having it?
Well, maybe, maybe not, since she does have a whole lot of wonderful bake shops. But her book is also a delight, and it's called How to Boil an Egg, which gives you some kind of vague idea
now,
why did we
talk to her in Paris? Does she live there?
Part of the time, yes.
Part of the time, okay.
Yes.
And I guess they do eggs well in Paris, too, huh?
Sure.
Okay, well, you'll know a whole lot more about Des Oeufs and how to cook with them right after this interview, which is upcoming right now.
Rose Carrarini, that is an Italian name. Her husband has an Italian name, although he's French, and you're English. We have quite an international thing going on here, because we're talking about your new book called How to Boil an Egg, which is, it's absolutely a delight.
Thank you.
For some background, you actually are almost iconic for a small chain of bake shops bake shop cafes in Paris, London, and I didn't understand why Seoul, Korea.
Well, it started off with Japan as our first thing. It's basically, the London thing came about because of the Comme des Garçons Dover Street concept store, and they asked us to do a little rose bakery in it. Now, they went on to open another store in Seoul, so they asked us to be part of that as well. And same for Japan, because they are a Japanese fashion company. And so we started off doing these little cafes within stores, and but Japan itself has taken on its own identity now, so we have our own self-standing rose bakeries there now as well.
Now, you and your husband were in the food business before, though, in London, right? With a,
yes.
With a delicatessen, a rather fine delicatessen.
That's right, in London. We started that in 1988, but it was more French-inspired because in London, that in those days, there was very little that I could find that I really liked in terms of French produce, so we imported and did the whole thing on a French basis. When we came to Paris, however, we switched it and changed it to an English concept.
So you flipped it entirely.
Yeah,
huh?
Absolutely.
The book itself is, first of all, it's a stunning orange in color.
Right.
And the subject, I mean, what led you to this concept about all these ways of cooking eggs?
Right. Well, actually, I can't claim to be the owner of that. Biden approached me as a second book to do a book on eggs, and my first reaction was no. I never really thought of eggs in any particular way. But they insisted, and I went away to think about it. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized that so much of what we do in the bakery is based on eggs. And without eggs, there wouldn't be almost a bakery. So it became interesting to me, a challenge to me to start the book on eggs.
Well, now, how did you get to this concept of these wonderful illustrations instead of photographs?
Well, I didn't want photographs because basically every cookbook out there, most of them anyway, is photographed. And I also didn't want any illustration because if you can't really see the food, exactly what it's supposed to look like, that's very frustrating for a cook who wants to look at the food. And so the only possibility was going to a painter, and that is a botanical painter, who paints in such fine detail, it almost becomes, you know, like a photograph.
It looks like, and they look like photographs. They're just absolutely amazing.
Yeah, they are wonderful.
The thing they remind me of most is Audubon's birds.
Uh-huh.
If you remember, they're the same incredibly precise illustration that looks like a photograph, except it's got this element to it. That in fact, somebody actually pictured it and then created it from scratch on a blank piece of paper. It's quite amazing.
Yes, it's absolutely, and it was very important that the book was beautiful as a just work of art or whatever it was, than just recipes and photographs and recipes and photographs. It was important to me that. So
now the artist's name is Fiona Strickland. I think we ought to mention her.
That's right. She's up in Scotland. I actually never met her before the book was published. We just communicated a bit. Fiden just took the photographs of the food that we decided, and then she has spent 3 years painting them.
Wow, 3 years.
3 years. So this, I actually wrote all these recipes 3 years ago, so my memory is not that great.
So she didn't actually see the dish itself.
She saw
a photograph of it.
She painted from photographs, yes.
Now, one of the things that amazed me was your tips, techniques, and ingredients. As you can well imagine, we get our fair share of every variety of cookbook through our doors. And you actually have tips about eggs that I didn't even know about.
Oh, really? Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
That's marvelous.
Yeah.
We actually thought we knew quite a lot about eggs.
I thought I knew everything that there was to know about eggs.
But something funny about that is because we have, it's my own way of cooking eggs, but working in a restaurant and dealing with people and their different tastes and different takes on how an egg should be, you find and discover that everyone has their own ideas and how they do it and how they would like their eggs to be. So it's quite fascinating. The tips I've given in the books is just how I like to have my eggs. it's not necessarily the right fit.
You recommend keeping your eggs in the refrigerator. We were just visiting Peter's family in Cornwall over Christmas, and they didn't put their eggs in the refrigerator at all, and most of his family doesn't. But I always, we always do.
Here are the two $64,000 questions, if you like, to put it that way.
Yes.
Why do you store eggs pointy side down? When they come in the carton, they're pointy side up.
No, I think it's in reverse, isn't it?
No. When you buy them at the store, they come pointy end upwards.
Pointed upwards, yes.
But then you say, and we bow to your superior expertise, but why do you have to turn them over?
You know, I can't remember even saying that.
Well, you know, I mean, I don't remember the context of the discussion I had with a bakery
yes.
cookbook author,
yes.
And she's a baker, and she and I argued about whether the eggs came with the pointy side up or down from the store.
Well, I can't remember actually saying, and you know, for the life of me, I can't remember the reason for it.
okay.
Unless I'm even cooking, when you want to sort of move them around a bit so that the yolk doesn't stay on one side and not the other. But I can't see any purpose in keeping them the other way up.
here's the section that it's in. It's in the section where you talk about how you can tell whether eggs are fresh by floating them. And if they float in a certain way, that means they're fresh. And if they float the wrong way, then that means they're stale.
That's right. That's right. I discovered that. That's right. True. It is a way of testing them. And if they point upwards, that's right. It's not keeping them in a certain way. It's testing the freshness. Yeah.
Well, you actually do say in the book you should store them pointy side down. I mean, if you ever find out why, would you let us know?
I will. I must have read that as an extra thing from somewhere, and I just added it. So I have to do my research again.
It's so funny. We have a thing. Anne and Peter have a thing about boiled eggs, I guess.
Okay.
There's a long story behind that, which I won't go to in major detail, except that one of the few possessions that I treasured when I met Anne for the first time was an egg cup with bunnykins on it.
No, it's Beatrix.
Oh, cute.
Well, I actually have two. I have a bunnykins and a Beatrix Potter.
Oh.
So I used to like boiled eggs. So Anne called me Rabbit after my egg cups.
Oh, that's cute.
And she still does that today.
But when we
boil eggs, we always boil jumbos, and we start them in cold water.
Oh, really?
And we have this machine that Anne bought like 35 years or so ago, which actually pierces the shell.
Oh.
So it relieves some of the pressure so your eggs don't crack during the cooking process.
Oh, my goodness. That's amazing. That's wonderful.
Let's talk a little bit about the range of this book.
Oh, sure,
it's not
absolutely.
Just that you...
Right.
You,
yes.
Although I must say your roasted asparagus, souffle, looked so absolutely delicious I could die. Isn't that your book? I don't know. Anyhow, you have all these, this whole range of things like poached eggs and tomato and fennel broth. Now that sounds wonderful.
Yes, no. I surprised myself the more I got into the book, because it started off just as a simple how to boil, poach and everything. And they, in fact, wanted me to give the very simple details of that. But the more I got into it, the more I started doing things like soups, which I would never have thought of as being using egg and so on and so forth. So I got really sort of fascinated by these different ways of using eggs as noodles, you know, and other kind of things. They're so versatile. They really are. And I could have gone on much longer, but we had to stop somewhere with the recipes.
You have a wonderful picture and a recipe for what I think you call them lacy eggs.
Oh, yeah. What is
Try to explain on the air
it's
if you can.
Over vegetables.
How you actually managed to do that.
Which is the story? Can you say the name again?
I think it's sort of lacy eggs.
Oh, lacy eggs. Yes, of course. Very, very hard to achieve, I must say.
Okay.
Takes a bit of time, but you need like a sort of a warm frying pan on the heat with a very little scraping of oil at the bottom of it. and then you whip up some eggs so they really are quite loose and watery and completely well mixed. There's no white and yellow. And then you just use some kind of utensil, whether it's a spoon or a little jug, and you just kind of put the egg in almost, you can do it with a fork almost, spraying it over the pan, leaving lots of little holes, and then the egg will slowly cook, and you lift that up very carefully. So it's like lace.
So you sort of dribble it in, I guess.
Dribble it in, yes, as best you can. So everyone's going to be different. It's very hard to control, but it makes a very light topping for vegetables or salad or anything. It makes it just very pretty.
Well, you know, I think that if anybody takes a peek at what you list as your larder ingredients, they'll
right.
get an idea of the soup of this book. It's not a routine book.
Okay.
List as essential things. Assure
yes.
you,
yes.
you know, what's Yasson syrup? What's that? I mean, it's, you
yes.
know, just, what's arame, a dried seaweed, dashi?
It's a Japanese seaweed, yeah.
And
yeah.
marigold bouillon powder. I mean, it's really an interesting book. So in addition to being beautiful, it's an really interesting take on a very common subject, the egg. But it's also,
yes.
they're wonderful, interesting recipes. In
yeah, thank
well.
You.
Well, I
thank
hope
you
this
very
is
much.
Like,
I want your answer to one more question before we go off the air.
Yes.
Are brown eggs really better than white eggs?
Well, you know, it's the same old question. Is brown flour better than white flour? For me, it's always been a visual thing plus a sort of healthy thing. I don't think it matters at all. I don't think as an egg it matters. It's just a visual thing for me. I like the look of brown eggs rather than white
right.
eggs.
The thing that surprised me is you said that the color of the yolk had nothing to do with anything in terms of the taste.
This is what they tell me. I always assume the more yellow they are, the better nutrition was given to the hen. But they say it's not necessarily true. It's basically what...
The orange ones in Spain taste better than the
yeah.
Well, it's one of those mysterious things like why you're supposed to put your eggs pointy side down in the refrigerator.
They're pointy side down. I know. I'm never so sorry.
So if you ever figure that one out, be sure to let us know.
I will. I will make some more inquiries there. I'm just really interested now.
Well, Rose, it's been a delight talking to you, and
it'd be nice
to meet up sometime. So,
absolutely,
thank you very much. Good luck with your book.
Thank you. Take care.
Okay, coming up in the final segment, what do we have, dear lady?
Well, it's a title to conjure with. The Cassoulet Saved Our Marriage. And I think we'll just listen to
these stories.
And with the editor.
And you'll probably have some stories of your own you'd like to add when you're done listening to this. So, please don't send them to us, but try and get a book published about them if you can.
Sometimes in life, we hit on an accident of friendship and collegism. What is that word? I'm talking to Caroline Grant and Lisa Catherine Harper. And their book, The Cassoulet Saved Our Marriage, which is really, it's an anthology called True Tales of Food, Family, and How We Learn to Eat. You started out in different places and ended up on the same spot in preparation for this book. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, we were both, this is Lisa speaking, we were both writers. I was working on a memoir about motherhood and becoming a mother, which became the book A Double Life. Caroline was the editor-in-chief of a really excellent website called Literary Mama, and she was also working on a book called Mama PhD, and we met through our correspondence when I submitted stories to Caroline for publication on her site. And I learned that Caroline really cared about food and really cared about family, and I had this idea for a book with the title Learning to Eat floating around in my head, but I didn't know what the book was until one morning I woke up and I said, oh, it's an anthology. It's a series of stories and essays about how families learn to eat, and Caroline is the perfect person to work on it with me.
Wonderful.
And I called her up and I approached her, and we've had a really tremendous collaboration.
Now, you're calling us from different phones. Do you actually live in different places?
We do. I live in San Francisco, and Lisa lives 40 minutes south of San Francisco, and as our editorial conversation deepened and we became friends, we would meet with our kids. We met at Golden Gate Park, and I remember specifically one morning as the kids were circling around hungry, and we broke out our snacks, and we sort of eyed what each other was feeding her kids. And there's always some anxiety at that moment. Is the other mother going to judge what I'm feeding my kids? And we got to talking about that moment and how there's so much judgment around food on the one hand in our culture today, so much anxiety on the other. And we really just wanted to step away from that, really change the conversation and talk about just what these foods mean in our lives.
Tell me this. I mean, that's a starting point. You're going to do this book. What is the next step? Do you scope out the subjects you want to cover? Do you list people you want to contribute? What's the next step?
Well, one of the interesting things about our collaboration, and this is Lisa speaking, is Carolyn and I, for all of our like-mindedness and our ethos about food, we come from slightly different places. Caroline lives in the city. I live in the suburbs. Caroline's family is vegetarian. We are meat eaters. So we eat very different kinds of things, but our ethos about what we eat and what's important in a family food life is very, very compatible. So when we started thinking about the book, we sent out a call to first writers we knew who we thought had interesting food stories, and we said to them, how did you learn to eat? How are you teaching your children to eat? And we started getting back really interesting stories.
Now, who exactly are Deborah Kogan and Paul Kogan? Because they wrote the title essay,
yes,
or the essay that became the title, The Cassoulet Saved Our Marriage. And who are they? They know the similar people we know, so I was wondering if our paths had ever crossed.
Well, Deborah is a novelist. She spent years as a photojournalist, and Paul is her husband, I believe a classmate of Lisa's in college. Is that right, Lisa?
That's correct.
And they met in Paris and courted in Paris, and then found themselves 10 years later living in New York, three children, in a somewhat rough patch in their marriage. And Paul suggested they make cassoulet to remind themselves of their early days of their courtship and their early love, and we'll make cassoulet and invite all our friends and our family over. And it's become a family tradition and a way for them annually to gather their loved one and celebrate.
Well, now I can't tell from the essay whether they broke up or they're together again. All I know is they're going to continue the cassoulet party.
They are, and you know, that's the interesting thing about the way that many of the stories in the book are pitched, is that certainly their story is partly about making cassoulet and how you make a cassoulet, but it's also about how working together on the cassoulet becomes a metaphor for working on all of the hard things that you have to work on sometimes in a marriage, and that food is about what you eat, but it's also about how you eat it and who you eat with, that there's a larger social and cultural and indeed family context around the family food. I'm happy to report that they are still together.
Oh,
they're
good.
Still married. They're moving forward. You can say that now that the book is out, but
well, that's encouraging.
So I think they write very honestly about the struggles that marriages can face.
Now, you explained this, how you structure and divide up this book. You have part one, food, part two, family, part three, learning to eat. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. The first section, food, is focused around stories of particular foods, the kinds of things that become traditions in your family. So, for instance, we have a story by Chris Malcolm, whose family owns one of the oldest Italian restaurants in Boston, about the red sauce.
Yeah.
That his great-great-grandfather developed, and how that recipe got passed down and changed or not changed over the course of generations. The second section is family, and that's really about the relationship that we have over the family table and how the food and what we serve in our families reflects our relationships for better and for worse. Carolyn, do you want to add anything about family?
Well, and I would say that, of course, that section also focuses on specific foods, but it's also about how food is a vehicle to connect back to our ancestors, to look forward, stories of woman making the Thanksgiving gravy and think of how her late father used to make that gravy. Another woman preparing the brisket for Hanukkah and remembering her late mother and how she always made the brisket. So food is that sense memory and that connection to the past.
And how you carry on family traditions as well. You know, and there's also a terrific essay by Catherine Newman called Talk With Your Mouth Full about cultivating family conversation around the dinner table and how that used to be really, really hard. And as our kids grow, how family dinner has become a place of a kind of raucous, joyful celebration. And the section Learning to Eat is all about how we, literally how we learn to eat, and how everything from, if you have a really picky eater, how does that picky eater learn to like other kinds of food? If you have, say, not just a picky eater, but a truly food-averse child who really won't eat to the point of being unable to thrive, how do you confront that problem? How do you decide whether or not to eat meat? How do you, Caroline has a great essay about how do kids learn how to feed themselves at school lunch? How do they learn to choose from the cafeteria line? Those are the kinds of stories that we offer in learning to eat.
I think a lot of those stories, too, are about how parents need to maybe step back and be patient while our children make untraditional, shall we say, food choices, and trust that they will get past this period, this stage of picky eating, or in my case, fifth grade, eating ice cream and french fries every day for lunch. And my mother just waited and trusted, and I forgot that lesson when my son headed off into the school cafeteria, and I needed to relearn. So my essay, as many of our essays are, it's not just the child learning something about food, but the adult, too, learning something new about food.
Now, many of the essays have a recipe associated with them. Do they all, or is it just most of them?
They all have a recipe, yes.
And that recipe has something to do with the theme, no doubt.
Yeah, so each recipe is by that essayist and keyed in some way to that essay. So I mentioned the Thanksgiving gravy, and that's an essay called Food of the Gods, and the author offers her recipe for a mystical gravy. We have a cassoulet guide, so if you can set aside 3 days.
Yeah, I saw that recipe.
And it's a great meal for a group. It's a very, frankly, it's a very economical way to feed a big group of people, and a really warm and lovely way to gather up people. There's very simple recipes for smoothies, desserts, liqueurs.
Now, did you have to weed through, eliminate essays that didn't quite get to the point you were trying to make?
We did, because as the book evolved over, it took us, you know, a few years to gather all the essays and to shape the book. And one thing that did become clear to us is that we were writing about American families and American food. So, for instance, we had a really interesting essay from an American woman who lives in Japan and how she was learning to feed her children in a more traditional Japanese way, but it just really didn't fit with the focus and the emphasis of our book. So it told a different kind of story. So those were the decisions we made, were more about, finding that, obviously a good quality essay that told an interesting story and that told a new story, but that also told an American story.
Did you get any that you thought were particularly surprising, where you got something different than you thought you were going to get?
Well, I'm thinking of an essay we received from an old friend, Princeton classmate of Lisa's, about candy.
Oh, yeah.
When we sent out this pitch, I wasn't thinking that we would publish an essay that included a recipe for Heath Bar French toast.
Yeah, that's
this
pretty funny.
Essay, sometimes you read something and you just know, and it makes you laugh, and it's so smart, and it's saying something you haven't read before. So that was a really wonderful surprise, that essay.
And then we also tried to include essays that came from sort of unexpected writers. For instance, there's a story, one of those stories that came to us in a very roundabout way is by Max Brooks, who's the author of World War Z and the Zombie Apocalypse book. And he's not really known for his food writing, but he's friends with another contributor in the book, and she had mentioned she was going over to his garden to go shopping. And I said, what do you mean you're going shopping at Max's house? And she said, he has an amazing garden. And I said, well, is that a zombie apocalypse thing? And she said, no, I think it's an Anne thing. And as it turns out, his mother, Anne Bancroft, and she apparently had this fantastic garden that she cultivated over decades.
Oh, wow.
And he had taken over her garden. And so we immediately got to him right away and said, would you please write us this story? And he very graciously agreed. And we have this beautiful, surprising story about this private garden of this very public figure and what it meant and what it continues to mean in her family's life. So a major aim of the book is telling new kinds of stories about food and showing that it's not just food writers and chefs and food journalists who have something to say about food, but that it matters in all of our lives and surprising and sometimes unlooked for ways. And so we've really tried to bring that forward through all of our essays to all of the writers.
And I think you did. I really think you did a wonderful job with this. I imagine it was very labor-intensive, but I think that the result is going to carry out. It's going to have a long shelf life, is what I think.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I wish you great success with this book and also with the next and the one after that and the one after that.
Thank you. We hope so.
Thank you.
And you have a blog going at the same time, too, right?
We do. It's simply learningtoeat.com. Right now, all this month, we're posting about our contributors, saying a little story about how they came to the book.
Oh, that's it.
And who doesn't?
We also post recipes, stories about food in our families.
And who doesn't need to learn how to eat? So we thank you for your contribution, and I can assure you that the copy we have will be well leafed through. It's already looking like that.
Yeah, I can't get the cover to stay down.
Anne said you can't get the cover to stay together. So thank you for your contribution, and we appreciate you taking the time to talk to us today on the menu.
Oh, thank you for having us on.
Thank you.
And that's a wrap for this week's program. We hope you'll join us again, same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.